Quick note before we get into the podcast. I'm testing something out. Call it a beta launch, if you will. See, my brothers and I used to collect sports cards as a kid, and it was pretty cool to have something tangible, a representation of a person or a team that meant something to us. And with the resurgence of sports card popularity, it got me thinking. I'm a sports podcast, and I host athletes on the show. I should have a sports card for the Science of Sports Recovery. So I created one. For this episode, it is literally the first ever print of the Science of Sports Recovery sports card. That's a lot of sports. And I'm giving them away for free. All you have to do is send me an email at jace@scienceofsportsrecovery.com. Hit me up on Instagram at jcheese, J-A-E cheese. Or leave me a voicemail through my website, www.scienceofsportsrecovery.com. Let me know that you want one, and we'll correspond to get your mailing address, and I'll ship one out to you. Now, I'm only printing 50 this week, and there's already about 15 of them spoken for, so if you want one, act fast, because when they're gone, they're gone. If you want to see what they look like, you can check them out on my Instagram. They'll be, again, my Instagram is jcheese, J-A-E, cheese. So, if you want a Joe Rinaldi card from the Science of Sports Recovery team, talk to me. Okay, over to the episode now. You're listening to the Science of Sports Recovery podcast. I'm your host, Jace Kraft, and today you are chatting with Dr. Joe Rinaldi. Joe is a wealth of knowledge, and I'm very excited to get his take on recovery, perspective of sport, and having a champion mindset. Joe has had his share of challenges when it comes to sports, as he was diagnosed with Best disease at age 10. Best disease is a genetic condition that causes progressive degeneration of the macula and deterioration of central sight over time. Basically, he's been slowly losing his eyesight. So if you are a fan of powerfully motivating stories to help you put perspective in your life, you have to check out his blog at joerinaldi.blog and listen to the rest of this episode, obviously, as you will not be disappointed. With that, Joe, welcome to the show.
You're listening to the Science of Sports Recovery podcast. Each week, we explore how to recover more efficiently from training so you can work out harder and realize your full potential. This is the Science of Sports Recovery podcast.
Hey, Joe, welcome to the show.
Hey, Jace, thank you so much for having me here, man. It's Saturday morning, and there's no better way to start the weekend than with a good conversation.
Yeah, it was one of those nights that I woke up multiple times during the night because I'm like, don't miss my alarm. Don't miss my alarm. like before.
Are you an early riser?
I am. And I'm always up at 5:30 anyways. Yeah. But for whatever reason, even like when I have an event that's maybe at 9 or 10 in the morning, I still freak out the night before. So I don't oversleep, and it's whatever. It's one of my kryptonite.
Yeah, I'm the same way, man. Like, I don't have nightmares often, but when I do have nightmares, it's always that I'm missing like a really important test, and I hate that feeling.
Yeah. Yeah. Even when I was done with school, I still had those like late for class type dreams. Cool. Well, let's get into like why athletics are important to you, because obviously that's where you started. Then you've had some struggles with losing your sight with that, and then now obviously a dedicated career around physical therapy. So like, why is that a theme in your life?
Yeah, I mean, I guess to give a little bit of background, I played sports my entire life. So I'm 26 right now, And to take it back to childhood, baseball was my first love. Played baseball growing up. My dad played baseball in college. He coached my brother and I, and I loved the sport. And as you alluded to, I started to lose my sight as a child and started getting hit in the face with a lot of baseballs and decided it was probably best to move on to a sport that didn't require so much hand-eye coordination. So shifted to football. Played football all throughout, you know, elementary school, middle school, high school, a year in college. I also did track and field in high school. So threw javelin, pole vaulted. And athletics really is a big part of who I am. And the lessons I've learned, particularly on the football field, have carried over into everything else in life. And so I think for me, athletics is so important because I've learned so many life skills while playing sports, whether it was discipline or the value of work ethic or how to be a good teammate or how to just be a good citizen. I learned all of those things first through sport, and they carried over into everything else that I did. So I think more than just the physical nature of sport, it was the mental and just life lessons that I learned.
For sure. Did you know you were learning them while you were learning them, or is it now like retrospective, like, man, I'm glad I did that because now I'm this type of person?
It's such a great question. I think as I got older, I started to realize more and more what I was learning in the moment. But as a child, I had no idea. I mean, there's this story that I've actually never told, and it's kind of funny, but it was elementary school football. So I was maybe like 10 or 11 and the coach was late to practice. And so me and my teammates were, you know, in our pads, helmets, shoulder pads, and one kid picked up a rock and he threw it at someone else. And that kid picked up a rock and threw it at someone else. And we started having this rock fight and we were just throwing rocks at each other. And someone threw a rock and it hit a car and it dented the side of a car. And that happened like right as the coach was pulling into the parking lot and he kind of gathered what had happened, and nobody really knew who threw the rock, but me having just like, I have this like strong sense of like moral rightness. And I just stepped forward and I said, it could have been me. Like, I don't know. So he sat us down and he gave us this long, hard speech. And he made us run laps for the whole practice. I mean, it was brutal, but before he made us run, he said, he pulled me up in front of everybody. He nicknamed me Joe Rocks Rinaldi. And he said, we win as a team, we lose as a team, we have fun as a team, and we get in trouble as a team. And I'll never forget that. And we ran laps and I literally bawled my eyes out because I just felt so bad. And my teammates, you know, like patting me on the shoulder, on the helmet, like, it's okay, Joe, like, we're in this together. And I didn't realize it at the time, but years later, I realized it was just a lesson in ownership and accountability and just what it means to be part of a team. You win together, you lose together, you have fun together, and you get in trouble together. And so like lessons like that, I didn't realize until well after the fact, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. That's a great story about like just, you know, community. And I think in America, we have such a individualistic culture that we forget about like, you know, the people right and left of us. That's like, what can I do for me? Even in sports, you know, it's sometimes, especially when you get into like track and field and these endurance sports, or, you know, tennis, or that it's like really just one person. Like, how do you foster that community, like that you just told in that story, into a sport like track and field or tennis, when it really is like you against, you know, the competition?
Yeah, I think like, you know, one of the best things that I learned from track and field in particular, you know, we had this coach and he was he was probably in his 60s when he was coaching us, and he was still booking it. I mean, he was running like, you know, 5 miles at like 6 minute pace with the team. And every practice he'd sit the entire team down, like 100, 200 kids in the middle of the field. And he would call out one kid and he'd make that kid stand up and come to the middle of the circle that we're all sitting in. And he would ask one question. It was the same question every single time. And he would say, what is our one rule? And that kid would always answer, be a good citizen. And what that meant was, If one of your teammates fell down, even if they were a runner and you were a thrower, you pick that person up. And if there's a piece of trash on the ground, like, you pick it up. If someone needs help putting away equipment and that's not your job, you still step in and you help them out. And so it was really interesting because even though we all had these separate tasks and goals, we still functioned as a team and as a community. And our job was just to be a good citizen. And, I don't know the answer, like how we foster that more in society, but I think getting kids is at a young age involved in sport with great coaches who can instill those kind of values. And along with great parenting, I think that kind of sets the foundation for a better society.
For sure. Yeah, it definitely starts with the upbringing, and then that, you know, leads into a good adults. Who was your like most notable coach growing up, or
That's a great question. Like, I'm tempted to say my dad. He coached me all throughout youth sports. And he was just, I mean, I admire my dad in a lot of ways, and just full of integrity, great work ethic. But I think I'll put him aside because he's my role model for a lot of reasons. But my high school football coach, Coach DeSarno, he was just like this really caring, empathetic guy who also just knew how to command a room and knew how to inspire people and knew how to get people to do their jobs. And it was just this like really incredible mix of like, one second he was getting on you for not doing something to the standard or the potential that he knew you could do it. And so at the same time, while you were getting maybe sometimes even yelled at, you just felt loved and cared about. And you knew that he was giving you this feedback because he cared about you. Mm-hmm. And so working with him for 4 years throughout high school, he taught me so much about work ethic and discipline. And so he really stands out as a great coach in my mind.
How do you yell at somebody and still foster like you care about them?
You know what? That's such a great question. But, you know, I just have these memories of specifically I was a sophomore, and it was my first time I got into a varsity game, and I was on the punt team, and my job, I was the up back. So I was the guy who told everybody who they were blocking, whatnot. And so we punted the ball and I sprinted down the field. I was so excited. It was my first high school varsity game. And the ball was bouncing and rolling slowly toward the end zone. And so you want to touch it before it goes in the end zone so you can down it at like the 1 yard line. And I was coming in full steam and I dove on the ball and knocked it into the end zone. So it was a touchback. And so it was like, it was a mistake and I screwed up and I like had my head down and I jogged to the sideline and he was screaming at me. And then at the end of it, he just pulled me close to him and like kind of cradled my helmet and patted me on the head. And he said, "Shake it off. It's okay. Let's get it next time." And like, I don't know, is that like sense of like, he was almost giving me a hug. And after he was like, got out the frustration, like he just told me, "It's all right. Let's shake it off and we'll get it next time." You feel okay about it.
Yeah. That's a good example. And I know like with coaching, it can kind of, you can lean to two extremes. Sometimes you have a coach that like, you do nothing wrong, everything's positive. And then you start to never believe that coach, you know, cause you're like, okay, it really was, I just ran like 30 seconds off my PR or, you know, I just pushed the football into the end zone. Like that wasn't good, you know? But then you get the other side that everything is like not good enough. And then you never get that, like comfort in that they see potential in you. So I think that was a good mix there. So how was like, we talked just, you know, briefly on you losing your eyesight and stuff. And you mentioned you got hit by a lot of baseballs, growing up, talk us through just kind of what that is like, what it feels like, or what, like you're losing your eyesight. Is it just like getting blurry? Is it like times where you just can't see anything and then it comes back or how does that work?
Yeah, I could, I'll start practical and then go into the more big picture. But when I was 10 years old, I just woke up one morning from a normal night of sleep and just couldn't see out of my right eye. And it definitely, you know, there's a whole slew of emotions that hit you really hard when that happens, especially when it comes out of nowhere. And so my parents and I figured it out. We saw a bunch of different doctors and specialists, and I was diagnosed with this thing called Best disease. So Best disease is another word for juvenile onset macular degeneration. And for those of you who have no idea what I just said, the macula is responsible for your central vision. And so your macula in Best disease starts to deteriorate at a young age. And so you start to lose your central vision. So for me, when I look out of just my right eye at this moment, I have a big black spot in the middle of my field of vision. Takes up maybe 30 to 40% of my field of vision. So if I'm trying, reading is impossible. I can't look at a small object because as soon as I move my eye to look at it, it disappears in that black spot. And so that's my right eye. And so my right eye is more affected than my left. And my left eye is somewhat affected. Similar thing, it's just to a much smaller degree. And so with both eyes open, you know, I can compensate. I can read, I can drive, I can see things and do things. My depth perception is pretty off. So catching small objects like a baseball or if someone tosses me something, that's tough. And the disease is progressive. And so what'll happen is, the way, without getting too much into the nitty gritty of it, I have fluid, and sometimes it's blood, sometimes it's other fluid, will accumulate behind my retina, and it's not supposed to be there. And so the cells back there get irritated, and if it hangs out there too long, those cells die, and then they don't work anymore, and I lose part of my sight. Mm-hmm. But there are treatments that can stop the progression when those episodes happen. But whenever I get a treatment, things kind of calm back down, but they never get to where they were before the episode. So things are constantly getting worse, and the treatments help to slow things to an extent. And unfortunately, right now, there's no cure. There are things that are being developed. There's, you know, stem cell research and gene therapy and other things. But as it stands right now, there's nothing I can really do about it. And for throughout my childhood, that was really tough. I think I spent a lot of my childhood not expressing outwardly to other people how I felt, because I didn't, first of all, I don't think I really knew how I felt. I couldn't articulate it, but I also didn't think people would understand. And so I kind of just went through my childhood feeling sorry for myself, feeling really sad, feeling like I wasn't in control of things. And there was just a lot of uncertainty, and that was really hard for me to deal with. So I lacked a lot of confidence as a child, and, you know, throughout middle school and even high school a little bit. I started to come into my own in high school, and things somewhat stabilized with my sight. And, you know, I was able to function pretty well, get good grades in school, play sports, have friends. And, you know, I tried not to think too much about it. I really tried to avoid thinking about it as much as I could. Went to college. Things were somewhat okay. Until I started playing football my freshman year at Bucknell University, started noticing that when I was getting hit or tackling people, I would get up and my field of sight would be a little off. And so I went to the doctor, and the doctor said, "Hey, listen, like, you should not be getting hit in the face or hit in the head." So I had to stop playing football at that point.
Yeah. Mm. So You mentioned, like, you struggled with confidence, which totally understandable. You don't seem like you do now. Was that like a switch that was like, okay, I'm just going to, you know, not be confident, or I'm going to be confident? Or was it like gradual over time that you're starting to build like on things to now get to where you are?
That's a great, great question. It was, it happened really slowly over a long period of time, and then all at once. And to explain that a little bit more in depth, I think it would make sense to understand that right before I went to graduate school for physical therapy, a few weeks before school, I actually lost a large portion of my sight. And the timing was really rough because it made me second guess and doubt whether or not I should pursue school, whether or not I should move to a different city, I should take out student loans and tackle this big task. Just right after losing a big chunk of sight, right? It put a lot of doubt and self-doubt. And so those weeks leading up to school were really, really tough, but I decided to go anyway. And that first year of graduate school, living in the city of Philadelphia away from my family, was hands down the darkest, hardest, heaviest year of my life. And, you know, unlike everything else in life, I couldn't try harder and make myself feel better. Like it was with sports, with school, with relationships, I could just put in more effort and things would get better. Yeah. There was a correlation, and I would wake up every morning for that first year of school and tell myself, this is going to be a good day. And no matter how hard I tried, I just couldn't shake that dark, heavy, sad feeling. And and so, right, I went through that whole first year of school, on the outside looking fine to other people, you know, got good grades, made friends, did well.
Yeah.
On the inside, I was falling apart and I felt so alone. And it wasn't until I met my wife in school the first year, but it wasn't until the end of the first year that we started to spend time together. And when I started spending time with her, I started thinking less about how I was feeling, and I gradually started to feel better. And so I started to gain more confidence. And then I shared my first blog ever, which was about losing my eyesight. And it was a really vulnerable moment. And I put it out there, and the response was incredible. Family, friends, people who I hadn't even talked to in 10 years reached out to me and said, that's so inspiring. I'm supporting you. Or even like, hey, I feel really alone and dark right now, and your words really helped me. Thank you. And so I started to gain a little bit more confidence in being vulnerable. And so things started to slowly build. And then, you know, to make even more sense of this story, I need to talk a little bit about my faith, which, you know, I grew up in the Catholic Church growing up. I always knew that God was real. I believed in God, but I didn't know how to get closer to him. So I feel like my faith had kind of stalled out, or I was at a plateau. And that first year in school, when I was in that dark place, I thought, if there's a God, how could he let anybody feel this way? And I stopped chasing God. I stopped pursuing a relationship, and there I started spending time with this girl. I chased her instead. And little did I know that she was a person of really strong faith. And as we hung out more, she invited me to church. And I went to church with her. It was a Christian, non-denominational church. And I went with her because, of course, I'm not going to turn down spending time with the girl that I had a crush on. And so I stood next to her in church. And it was like in this moment, the music was playing, people were singing. And I just felt this overwhelming sense of like God's presence. And it was almost as if he was saying, hey, I know you didn't feel like I was there with you and you stopped chasing me, but I was always there with you and I never stopped chasing you. And right now you're right where you're supposed to be with the person you're supposed to be with. And I'm with you. Mm-hmm. And it was in that moment that all of that gradual change, it shifted and it flipped. And I started to believe that everything was happening for a reason. And there's this incredible quote that kind of defines my life up to this point by Christine Kane. And she says, sometimes when you're in a dark place, it feels like you've been buried, but you've actually been planted. And it was in that moment that I realized I had been planted. All of the struggle, all of the hardship, all of the uncertainty in my life had led me up to that point. And that woman is now my wife. And it's been since that point, which is about, let's say, 3.5-4 years ago, where everything switched. My eyesight went from an absolute burden to an absolute blessing. And I truly, truly believe that everything's happening for a reason. I'm so grateful for the fact that I'm losing my sight. And I know that's such a crazy statement, but that's where I sit today.
Hmm. Yeah, that it's you hear like these overnight success stories, you know, in business, which are never true either. They're like, you know, 20 years in the making or 12 years in the making. And that's just what I kept thinking of when you were telling your confidence story, like, hey, you know, I had to put in the work back here. But then, you know, this one moment kind of brought all that work together. And then now it's like an overnight success type of deal. So,
exactly.
So you said you went to Philly away from your family. I would imagine that your parents struggled with that, or were they supportive?
They were very supportive of me. I think the thing that they struggled with was hearing me on the phone every single night crying for that first year and not feeling like they could make a huge difference because they tried everything. And I knew they were there for me. But I think for them, it was just this feeling of, well, he's got to figure this out. And I'm not sure how much we can help. We could just be there. But yeah, so they were there for me big time. But I needed to figure it out for myself.
Yeah.
If you stick around and listen to enough of our episodes here on the Science of Sports Recovery podcast, you'll notice a common theme of importance of mobility in recovery and injury prevention. That's why I recommend checking out the Ready States Virtual Mobility Coach to help you improve your mobility, recoverability, and injury prevention. The Ready State is a brainchild of coach and athlete Dr. Kelly Starrett, who you can learn more about on episode 13. His virtual mobility coach program helps athletes understand the importance of recovery, pain relief, and self-care. In other words, it helps fix the recovery side of training so you can keep seeing results from your workouts. His program will guide you through the same mobilizations used on athletes in the NFL, NHL, and MLB, provide custom tools for pain relief, give you customized pre and post exercise mobilizations based on your training and sports schedule, and deliver daily mobilizations to keep you on track to achieve your goals. You put your heart and soul into your workouts. Make sure you get the most of them by going to thereadystate.com/Jace. Again, that's thereadystate.com/JASE. The link will also be in the show notes. Now, back to the show.
If somebody was in your like situation, I don't think we, as a society, we teach people how to interact with somebody who's hurting, or I think there's such this like barrier of like, oh, you feel this way. I don't know like what to say. And then we try to say things that we think will make you feel better. Like, you know, everything happens for a reason, or, you know, what have you. And most of the time that doesn't help any because it's so internal. Like you have to go through the struggle yourself, I believe, and kind of reconcile that with yourself. But from the outside, like, what would you say is the best way to comfort or support somebody who's just really going through a rough time, whether it be something like, you know, Best disease or a huge injury or, you know, anything like that? How do you comfort people?
Yeah. As simple as it is, and I think I've definitely noticed this more and more throughout my career practicing as a physical therapist, but honestly, I think it's just being there. And it sounds ambiguous, and it sounds passive, and it sounds too simple. But I think sometimes people just need to know that you're there, understand that you're listening, and know that you care about them and that you love them and that you're going to stand by their side no matter what. And sometimes it just looks like checking in with somebody once in a while and sending an encouraging text and letting them know that you're thinking about them. Because I think at the heart of what I was struggling with, at least, was that I felt alone and I felt like nobody could relate or nobody understood what I was going through. And that feeling of being alone is terrifying because, you know, at the end of the day, I think like human connection is one of the most important needs, like the most important, like hands down, right? Like loneliness, there's research on this. Loneliness kills more people than many diseases. And so I just think letting people know that they're not alone and just being there. And maybe that means physically being there. Maybe that means, again, just emotionally being there and checking in with people. But I'd love to tell this short story that kind of it lays the foundation for a lot of what I do. And so When I was in middle school, there was this speaker that came in to talk to us, and I don't remember his name. I don't really remember what the talk was about in its entirety, but I remember this one story that he told, and it stuck with me. It sticks with me to this day. So it's a true story. And there was this man a few years back, or a while ago now, who committed suicide by jumping off of the Golden Gate Bridge. And when the police did their investigation, they found a note on his nightstand table. And the note said something to the effect of, you know, I'm alone in this world. Nobody cares about me. Tomorrow morning at rush hour, I'm going to walk 1 mile to the Golden Gate Bridge and take my life. If one person smiles at me, I won't do it. And I get the chills every single time I tell that story, or I think about it, or I write about it, because this man presumably walked past thousands and thousands of people at rush hour on a weekday to take his life. And not one person even just looked up and made eye contact with him and shot him even the slightest smile. And little did anybody else know, but that smile could have deterred him from taking his own life. And so I think, like, right, when people are hurting and we know about it, like, be there for them. But I think we also have to be aware that how we carry ourselves and how we're there for complete strangers sometimes, even if it's just a smile or a genuine compliment or holding the door, like, that can alter the path of a life. And, you know, it might not be every person that walks past you where that's the case, but maybe it's 1 out of 100, maybe it's 1 out of 1,000, maybe it's 1 out of 1,000,000. But if you can smile, if you can make eye contact, be friendly, do nice things, you never know what, you know, you could save a life and you have no idea. And so, like, I just personally want to live my life in a way where every single person I come across is in some way, shape, or form touched in a positive way. Because I just, after hearing that story and knowing the impact that even a smile could have, I can't let myself not try to be a light for someone else.
For sure. I mean, like, positivity has such an impact. It's like planting the seed that, you know, God can grow into somebody, you know. And I noticed this, like, you know, taking it to like a sport application. So in high school, I was like my senior year, I had the second fastest mile in South Dakota, during that year. But I was in the smallest class and I was competing like with the largest class. So at state, when I was like, I really stood out because I was, you know, seconds ahead of everybody in multiple events. I don't say that to brag, but I say that because, like, when you're at that point and like athlete, like, people look up to you, whether it's right or wrong, people do. But then you have that opportunity to really impact people's lives then by, honestly, just paying attention to them. Like, I kid you not, I had people, like, after high school, I came back to some of the same meets in college, just because I stayed in town and ran, you know, we had some joint meets, and I had high schoolers that were seniors come up to me and say, you know, when you were a senior, you were kicking everybody's butt. I was just a freshman and I was way back in eighth place, but you paid attention to me afterwards and, you know, talked and you said this to me and it really made an impact on my career. And it's like, I don't remember talking to them at all at that, you know, afterwards, but like in the moment I was paying attention to them and it has an impact. And I think that's like, just from, you know, the kind of the moral of what we've talked about, from, you know, just paying attention to somebody who's hurting, to, you know, paying attention to strangers, because you never know what kind of impact that will have on them, you know, years down the road.
Yeah. So. Oh, that's such a great story. And it's definitely so true. Like, you never know who's watching. And to that effect, right, one of the best lessons I've ever learned from sport has just been integrity and how to live a life full of integrity. And so, in high school, we watched film for football. You know, we'd pick apart things that we could do better or film about the other team. But in college, we watched film on everything. every single practice. We watched every single minute of every single game, practice, anything you can think of. Mm-hmm. And it was all on film. And so if you were walking on the field and not giving your best effort, you'd be called out for it and the whole team would see it and you'd be held accountable. If you made a mistake, the whole team would see it and you'd be held accountable. And then when I stopped playing football, I realized like, hey, I don't have that accountability anymore. So what if I just lived my life like it was on film? Because you never know who's watching. And so I kind of have that, like that got that mentality in my mind that every single thing that I do, like I have no idea who's seeing that, who's listening to it, who's being affected by it. And so it kind of comes back to this overarching theme for me, at least, that life is bigger than me and everything that I do has the potential to make this world a better place, to touch somebody in a really meaningful way. So I try to use that ideology to like guide everything and give my best effort, even when I don't feel like it, because I know it could really change someone's life.
Yeah, that's great. What if everything was on film? That's great. So I want to get into the like taking care of the mind in athletics, and you have a pretty unique perspective on this just based on your history. So why do you think, like, from a recovery standpoint, from an athletic performance standpoint, like, why is it important to take care of the mind? When all sport is talked about the body.
Yeah. Yeah. I think you hit the nail on the head. Like, sport focuses a lot on the body. And we're starting to focus more on the mind. And there are plenty of great people out there who are working on helping people shift their mindset around sport and while they're performing and centered on athletics. But I think too often we neglect like what's happening outside of sport, what's happening outside of athletics with the mind, because we talk a lot about, and you specifically too, like you talk to a lot of people who talk about bodily recovery and rest outside of athletics so we can perform better in athletics. But I think too often we forget that like the mind needs rest too. The mind needs variety. The mind needs to recover and recharge. And so I think especially for high level athletes and people who are really focused on their sport, it's tempting and easy to spend all of your waking hours thinking about that sport or that endeavor and how you can get better at it. But I think just like you need to recharge a phone or recharge an electronic device, we have to recharge our minds. And I think sometimes that means stepping away from sport mentally and doing things that are completely different. And so for me, I spend all of my waking hours, you know, coaching people online, treating patients in the clinic physically, my own fitness and athletic endeavors. And so all of those things are body movement, exercise focused. And so for me, writing and reading and spending time with my wife where I'm not thinking about those things helps me recharge. So when I go back to them, I feel fresh and rejuvenated and energized. And I think too often we don't think about that in the world of athletics.
Mm-hmm. What would happen if you didn't recharge?
Honestly, I think like anything else, like I think we'd get tired. I think our effort would suffer in the athletic endeavor itself eventually, because we would feel burnt out. I mean, if you think about it in terms of work, right? If somebody sits at a desk and does, say you do accounting and you could do it for 8 hours a day and then you go home and you don't think about accounting, you play with your kids and you do, you know, exercise and you do things that are different, you can come back fresh and recharge. But the same thing goes for sport or athletics or exercise. If you do that 24/7, just like if you were to do accounting from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. and go to bed and do it over again, you'd probably lose some of your passion for it and lose some of your drive. Because I think as human beings, we need variety. Just like you can't eat you can't eat peanut butter sandwiches. I mean, if I could, I would. I would eat peanut butter sandwiches for every single meal every single day. I'm that kind of guy, but. But like my body would say, like I would fall apart. You know, you can't just eat the same thing every day for every meal, you know?
Yeah. So I was just thinking back to like my high school self when you were talking about that. And there'll inevitably be somebody listening to be like, Joe, that's all great, but I just love my sport so much that I can't stop thinking about it. I don't want to stop thinking about it. Like, it's my life. I love it. It's all I want to do for the rest of my life. Do you think it's still important for that person? That was me in high school. Do you think it's important for them to still like consciously step away from their sport every day?
The answer is 100% yes. The second part to that answer is convincing someone of that in that mindset, because I have been there as well. It's really, really difficult. And again, like, I don't think there are absolutes in life. Like, I don't think you could ever say always or never. And I think I just contradicted myself because I said you can never say always or never. But you know, there are seasons. And so maybe for somebody it makes sense where for 3 months out of the year they eat, sleep, and breathe their sport, and that's okay, and they can get away with it, and that's fine. But I think for long-term sustainable success, you have to have an alternate strategy where you are introducing variability into what you're thinking about as well as into what you're doing. So I would say, like, it's okay to do that maybe for a season of life or a season of sport. But for the long term, that's not sustainable. And the truth is, some people might not realize that until they feel it, until it actually starts to work in reverse, and they're burnt out and they're tired and they're losing their passion.
Yeah. And that was my story. Like, through high school, I was, you know, all gung ho, and I was waking up at 4 a.m, getting a workout in, going to school, going to basketball practice, running after basketball practice, going to bed at 8 to make sure I had my 8 hours of sleep, and then, you know, doing it every day. And then, like, that was fine through high school. I had a lot of success through high school, through, you know, first few years of college. But then as soon as I started to not improve, I didn't have that, like, you know, dopamine hit or whatever of PRing, I started to then go back, like, why am I doing this? You know, like, I've put so much in my life into this, and now I'm like training so hard, but I'm not improving. And then that led to, you know, a whole other things. And there are some things that if you listen to this podcast enough, you've probably heard me talk about it, but there's, you know, external factors that were keeping me from improving. But overall, like, I had to find at that point something outside of running, which happened to be entrepreneurship, and relationships. But it was like, it was a difficult transition for me, because up to my life, like, I just, everything I did was like, how does this affect my running, basically?
Yeah. I was the same way growing up, high school, college, even a little bit into graduate school. And, you know, I don't intend this to be a sad anecdote, but so my wife's grandfather just passed away last week, and he was 90. And he's got tons of grandchildren and great grandchildren. And we were at his funeral. And there's something about being at a funeral and just the emotional heaviness that makes you realize, like, how that person touched you and affected you, even if it was only for a brief period of time. And it gives you a new perspective that I hope I will be able to carry with me for the long term, because my temptation, whether it was sport, whether it was academics, or now whether it's work and entrepreneurship in my career, I have a tendency to go all in, and I am just laser focused on that thing. And I think one of my biggest fears in life is getting to the end and realizing that I worked so hard and so much that I neglected the things that were really, really important. And I realized, especially this week after having been at the funeral, that one of the most important things in life, if not the most important, are the relationships you have with the people who are closest to you. And And so whether it's athletics or work or whatever it is, like, I am just always pursuing, I'm trying to pursue better that balance, because I don't want to do great things in the business world or great things in the world of athletics or endurance sports and then die and have the people closest to me feel like they weren't close to me because I was never there. And so that's a hard balance. It's like kind of balancing ambition and things that feel urgent with things that are really important, but might not bring that like feeling of productivity or satisfaction in the short term. So it's that balance, man. It's a tough balance.
Yeah. There's so much in what you just said there. But like what, right at the end, you mentioned, you know, productivity versus things that are important, like relationships. And I like, it just so happened last night, I was actually talking with one of my friends and I said, man, I felt like I've done nothing today because I had like my to-do list of some things like podcast editing, you know, reach out to this person, get this email in, and those kinds of things that I had to do. And I had like two things off the list and I had like seven more to go. And it was like 8 o'clock at night. I was like, but then I looked back at my day and I was packed with meetings like from 8 to 5. I was like, well, no wonder why I didn't get any of this other stuff done, but it's like, but I was building relationship capital, you know? And
yeah,
I think that's important, but it's hard to quantify. So then it doesn't get, you know, things that get measured like improve, but we don't quantify or measure our time with relationships. And, but I think like it doesn't necessarily matter the time. We sometimes we think like time with equals like better, but I think, and maybe you could probably relate with this, but it's the like deeper you go, and you can go deep quick with somebody and rather than like shallow long term. How would you say like that is for you?
Yeah, I relate to everything you said so much. And I'm a big quote guy. And I have a quote that popped into my head from Albert Einstein. I think he said, not everything that counts can be counted, and not everything that can be counted counts. And I use that a lot to guide my physical therapy practice and my coaching practice, because I think a lot of times we get caught up in the things that get measured. But sometimes those things are not the most important things. And I agree with you 100%. I think you can get really deep really quick, or you can stay shallow for a long time, or you can, there's all these things in between. But I think that depth and quality and the meaningfulness of relationships are one of, if not the most important things in life. And, you know, you touch someone's life, you never know the ripple effects that that's going to have and how that other person will now touch other lives because of the way that you touch them. So I think investing in people, it could be messy, it could feel unproductive, it could be really hard, and it could sap a lot of your energy. But I think at the end of the day, that's the most important thing.
So do you think that like relationships is one of the best ways to like have out, like put your sport aside to kind of recharge, is to have relationships that aren't always talking about your sport?
Yeah, for me, that's the case. I don't know if that's the best way for everybody. And it's probably, you know, there's no one best way for everybody. But I think for a lot of people, that's a really great option. And I can tell you personally right now, I spend probably upwards of 80 or more hours a week working, probably closer to 90 or 100. And my time with my wife is really the time where I recharge the most, because we don't talk about those things. We have different interests and we just have this shared relationship where I could go and just feel like I could be vulnerable. I could be open. I know that I'm being heard. I know that I'm being listened to, and we could just have fun and do things that don't relate in any way, shape or form to my other endeavors. And then that just genuinely recharges me. So I think relationships are a great way.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think you need a relationship. I might be putting out a dangerous blanket statement here, but I think you need a relationship that's outside like of your sport that doesn't have like, they're not always going to not saying like not care about what you do, but like not really understand the sport itself. So they don't really know like the achievements or, you know, failures that you have. I think that the reason I think that's important is because then it gives you like perspective that your sport, like not everybody in the world cares about. And, you know, cause if you get into, yeah, you know, going back to like not being able to just do your sport 24/7, you know, 365 for really long term, I think the only way you could do that is if you were in a culture that that's all you knew and like that was the way of life, and you know there wasn't any outside, like you kind of like living in a bubble, but then that can be dangerous because then that becomes your life instead of like you the person. You know, because there's, as you know, especially as, you know, as being Christians, like there's more to life than just sport. It can be a part of you, but you, the person, you know, are more complex than just winning medals and, you know, achievements and that kind of stuff. So,
yeah,
but
I agree. I agree big time with that. I was just going to add that. Yeah, I think for us and anybody else out there who's listening who also shares a similar faith, right? Like failures for me, failures or setbacks or disappointments or struggle get a lot easier to deal with when you have the perspective that it's bigger than just us. Everything's happening for a reason. And that also, like at the end of the day, the most important thing can't be taken away from us. And so
yeah.
By that, I just mean our relationship with God and just like our identity in our faith. Like if that's, you know, if that's underlying everything you do, no matter what happens here on earth, no matter how many times you fall short or what happens, like that is always there to catch you at the bottom. And I think that's a really powerful thing.
Yeah. And the way I think about this, I'd be curious to see how you think about this, but my true self, my true identity, like, isn't my body. It's not, you know, my mind. It's like the spirit, if, you know, to put language to it. But it's, you know, some people think your spirit is like your thought life or, and then, you know, that controls your brain and your body and that kind of stuff. But I feel like I have this like true spirit that's living in this body. And then you can kind of separate then from, okay, my body's able to do this. But that doesn't mean that I'm less than somebody else because, you know, we're the same in spirit as far as, you know, potential and that kind of stuff. We're just given different bodies, but I'm curious to see how, your perspective on that.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think I probably don't. I don't know if I think as abstractly about it. I think maybe I think more often like I don't like titles necessarily because I think like doctor of physical therapy or performance coach or like those are all great things and whatnot. But I think like I am afraid of wrapping my identity up in those things. And I've had an issue in the past and probably still have this underlying like tie to my body because I'm a really physical person in nature. Like I love lifting weights. I love feeling strong. I love running. I love feeling capable physically. So I think it's funny, like I could lose my eyesight and I'm at peace with that. But if I lost my ability to move, I think I would struggle immensely with that. But so yeah, I identify more as like, I'm Joe Rinaldi, the person, a child of God. And I have this spirit inside of me that is like at my core, the most important thing. So I agree with you on that for sure. Yeah.
Cool. So how would you, or we're going to like wrap up here. But I want like you to tell athletes, if you could tell them one thing, leave them with one thing that might be going through like a big injury or a big setback, you know, or even best disease, like what would you tell them from just the life you live, your experience, like what you want them to take away. Yeah,
I've got this one. It's going to sound like, so this message, depending on when it finds you and who you are as the listener, like it might not sit well with you because you might not want to hear it. But at the end of the day, struggle, whether that is physical struggle, mental struggle, emotional struggle, that is the stimulus for strength. Every adversity and hardship, no matter how hard it is in this moment, is an opportunity to grow and get better. And everything in life is happening for you on purpose, with purpose, if you choose to see it that way. And so what I would say, if you just tore your ACL and your season's over, or you just lost a loved one, or you just ended your athletic career, right? Like this moment of struggle and uncertainty and potentially doubt and frustration, whatever other tough emotions you're dealing with, this moment is preparing you for what's next, and you have to embrace that and just take it one step at a time. Just as a runner, I'm sure Jace, you could relate to this, but when things get hard, you just have to focus on that next step over and over and over again. Just keep doing the next right thing in each successive moment. Just keep going, keep put one foot in front of the other, and trust that this is going to make you stronger, because it will in the end.
Yeah, you gotta be more like short-sighted in the moment. Like if you're in the middle of a 5K, it doesn't do you any good to think about the end, like the next 100.
Cool. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, if people need more Joe Rinaldi in their life, you do have an Instagram account at joerinaldi.dpt and a blog, joerinaldi.blog. Is there anywhere else people can find you, connect with you, reach out to you, or where are you most active?
Yeah, I'm most active on Instagram, so that's a great way. And if you find me on Instagram, you'll be able to find a way to everything else that I do, my writing, the podcast, everything else. So definitely reach out. I respond to everybody, and I would absolutely love to connect with anybody. And I mean that.
Awesome. Cool. Well, thanks so much for being on the show, Joe.
Yeah, thank you so much, Jace. It was my pleasure.
All right, episode's over. If you found value in this episode, please consider giving us a review on iTunes. And if you haven't already yet subscribed, do so now so you don't miss any important topics in the coming week. And if you have any questions or suggestions for the show, please send them my way. I am most responsive on Instagram. That's at jcheese, J-A-E, cheese, like the food, or email me directly at jace, J-A-S-E, at scienceofsportsrecovery.com. Talk soon.